This is Susan Robb for Teachers for a New Era. I'm talking with George Nicholson. George has worked in children's publishing for more than 35 years. He started as an editor with Golden Books. He founded Delacorte Books for Young Readers and Yearling Books. He was also a publisher of books for children and young people at Viking Press and publisher of Bantam Doubleday Dale Books for Children. Since 1995, he's worked at Sterling Lord Literistic as a senior agent. His clients include Lois Duncan, Patricia Riley Giff, Harry Mazur, and Zilpha Keatley Snyder, to name a few. He also manages literary estates, including Don Freeman's, the author of Corduroy, Hardy Grammatke, who did Little Toot, and Howard Garris, who had done Uncle Wiggily. So, George, the first thing I wanted to ask you is that you've seen a lot of changes in children's publishing, and I wondered which historically do you think had the most impact on you?
Well, I think when I began, one of the fascinating things about being in children's books is that it was considered, after my Golden Press experience, which was exclusively in children's books, I was considered an editor with a specialty. I attended the editorial meetings of the entire firm and felt free to comment on almost any book that was contracted for. I had it both ways in the sense that most of those editors knew nothing about children's books, nor were they deeply interested in what I did. But I was very interested in what they did. And I felt that an understanding of the general publishing field was important for me to understand what I was doing. That was particularly evident when I went to the Viking Press in the 70s, because I walked in the door and there were some extraordinarily distinguished editors. I remember Malcolm Cowley, the critic, Elizabeth Sifton, Alan Williams. They were great names in those years. And the moment I walked in the door, I was given a kind of respect that I'd never had before, because they understood that what I did had significance not only in the history of Viking, but in the general field. And it gave me a tremendous sense of pride and pleasure in what I was doing in a house that had a very distinguished backlist. And my chief task was to honor that backlist. But of course, in the 70s, we were very conscious of what happened in the 30s and 40s and 50s. In my time at Dell Publishing, shortly before Viking, I met every one of the great editors in the field, Ursula Nordstrom at Harper, Margaret McElderry, who remains a friend to this day, and many others who taught me what they had done and made me realize what a rugged job they had in convincing people that quality books for children were worth something. And I straddled, having started on the paperback side and the quote mass market side, at a something of a disadvantage, because I thought, oh, paperbacks and Golden Books. And I felt sort of from the other side of the tracks. So when I got to Viking, I thought, boy, I've made it. But in fact, they were very conscious of what the mass market was doing. And you have to remember that mass market was a distribution term. It had nothing really to do with the quality of the material that was being published. It simply meant books that were not sold in regular book outlets. Very few Golden Books were sold in bookstores. Originally, very few paperbacks were sold in bookstores. Almost all of them were either to schools and libraries directly, before the day the libraries were willing to accept paperbacks at all. But gradually, as the years went on, the different methods of distribution became crucial to the entire industry. And as a result of that broader understanding of how books could be sold, many houses began to absorb one another. This had always been part of publishing going back to the 19th century. But to build that bottom line, the fastest way to do it is to acquire another house and its backlist. So that happened regularly throughout the 80s and 90s. That appears to have reached a peak today, because there are very few independent houses left. Today, in December of 2008, we have the vision of Harcourt Houghton Mifflin teetering on the brink. Every time there's difficulty there in an underfinanced, hedge fund-owned firm, every article that talks about distress there says that parts of the company are for sale because it's the only way they can raise capital. What will happen to the juvenile department, we don't know. But it will either be sold to somebody, one of the giants, and it may disappear altogether, even as Harcourt has disappeared into Houghton Mifflin to some degree. So it's deeply troubling. On the other hand, I'm an optimist and think maybe it will survive, at least the children's book side. Interestingly enough, Dell Publishing, where I worked all those years ago, exists today only in its children's book department. Delacorte Press is almost entirely children's books and yearling books. And there is no Dell Publishing in quite the way that it was. Bantam no longer exists except peripherally, because those lines were dissolved into one another. Viking has kept its identity as part of the Penguin Group, and interestingly is the source of the various incomes within Penguin of traditionalism, partly because they've had a splendid editor who's been there for a long period of time and recognizes the traditions, as most of the editors at the newer, at the other imprints, they're not necessarily newer, have lost their way to some degree, in my view.
What do you envision currently as some of the most important changes in children's? We've had all kinds of, we've had format changes, we've had, you know, more globalization. So what are the things that you think are going to have define where we're going from here?
Well, it's very hard, but I think if you look at the history of all this, cycles reemerge. I have great hopes that despite the dreadful economic circumstances, that institutional sales, school libraries and public libraries, will reemerge. I think they're rethinking now what they do for their audiences, the general public and children as well. The new administration has a lot of burdens, but it does seem to respect education. So my hunch is in the next 4 to 6 years that this market will reemerge. Bookstores, I don't know. You know, a few years ago there were 700 children's bookstores, now there are 40 or 50 who are passionate and survivors, but increasingly are changing what they sell and how they buy. One of the great problems has been the diminution of the effects of the prizes, the Newbery and the Caldecott. Recently there have been articles saying that the selections are less on target than they once were. I think that's true, but those one article in School Library Journal particularly I don't think went far enough in explaining what the homogenization of public taste has occurred. Recently in the CCBC blog there's been an ardent defense of the novels of M.T. Anderson. And some people say kids just don't read them, indicating they shouldn't buy them. So the period when anything that was given a prize or on a best list was almost automatically bought is gone. I think the best way to achieve this is the sending writers out on the road and having them sell their own goods. The more people see of authors, the more likely they are to buy the author's books. But one of the things I've seen, too, is authors getting discouraged much more quickly if they haven't made it in some major way. They think, why am I doing this? And maybe this is just the law of nature that the writer who doesn't feel strong enough about what they're doing, maybe they should drop out. It's a hard thing for an agent or for an editor to do. You can't make writers write if they don't really want to. Commodity is one thing, but literature is another. I think all of us from a certain period are straining for literary books because we know they're the ones that are likely to last. But these books that go out of print in a year or two, the chick lit kind of phenomenon, there's always something like that. But of course the toughest thing is because of the control of Barnes & Noble, and I don't mean to make them out the villains, they didn't set out to be, but because everything is based on numbers. For instance, a second life in paperback is more and more difficult to achieve. I have any number of clients who've been told that if Barnes & Noble says the hardcover didn't do well enough for us, no matter what the book, we won't take the paperback. So the publisher says, well, we won't do a paperback. So writers say, well, let's get those rights back. So what do we do with them if we got them back? Well, I think what may reemerge is the growth of independent imprints. I think several people in the adult world have said, let's just sell off the trade divisions. They can never sustain the giganticism, you know, big buildings on Broadway with vast overheads. Small trade publishing can't do it. So maybe it's time we broke away from the big houses. There are certainly editors who are passionate enough to keep the machine much smaller going.
Now, what do you think, because that brings up the question of self-publishing too, which, you know, to this point, people have had different views on, but one of the things that is changing, I think, is that you have a lot more resources. If you wanted to hire, if you independently wanted to hire an art director or an editor, you could get some very fine people, a designer, whatever. So what do you think about that? I mean, is self-publishing in a more sophisticated fashion possible?
I think it is. I think one of the fascinating things is how national everything in publishing has become. Of course, getting books reviewed is the major problem. And unless the books are available in the chains or nationally, or more importantly, in the jobbers and wholesalers, they won't be reviewed in the traditional media. Now, the adult journals often will find the small imprint in California or Montana, wherever it might be, and note a book. And certainly sales departments in the big conglomerates are very much on the lookout for small books that are published regionally that might be made national. So there is that possibility. But the problems are huge. And of course, as newspapers are beginning to go, and you have to, the level of criticism has dropped dramatically. I think the major children's reviewers have to rethink what they're doing. And there was a time when School Library Journal was able to review virtually everything that was faintly responsible. Now it can't. If you talk to any of the reviewers, they can barely get the boxes open, much less assign them. And the journals like School Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, have dropped payments to their critics. All the critic gets is a free book. So. Can they sustain themselves? There seemed a time when Kirkus would review books not on the paper journal, and they do a little, but I think they're going to have to do a lot more, because I think the librarians know now how to find reviews if they're published in any form. But it's asking a lot.
Now, what do you think, there are a couple different things. I mean, first, how, if it's happened, do you think parents and children have changed over time toward reading? I mean, it's, you know, our notion of family time and all of those kinds of nurturing things are just different. So what do you think, and what impact does it have?
I don't know. The way families operate is has always been my own experience in a heavily reading family. I don't remember that my mother or father sat down and read stories aloud to us. I remember vividly being read to aloud in school. But of my five brothers, three of us are real readers. The other three simply aren't. Doesn't mean they can't. They just read differently and they read different things. So the same experience has different results. It doesn't have anything to do with family feeling or friendship, but it has. I hesitate to make any general remark. I've never met a parent, though, who said outright, I don't want my child reading. You come across those parents in stories sometimes, but I don't know really that they exist. I don't really have an answer, except that every experience is different. The more we can do to encourage families to do things together, those things will be shared. But the greatest problem, I think, for young people, and I'm talking people in their teens and 20s, is their inability to be alone. And I'm afraid I'm guilty of it. When I get up in the morning, I turn on the Today Show just because I use it as the radio. I don't watch it, but it's on while I'm getting ready to come to work. But I don't flip on the television every time I walk into a room. And I have to just, I've learned to read differently as I got older, because I have to find the time to read. I can read fiction, for instance, only on weekends. This is adult fiction, because I feel very strongly that anyone in children's books has to have a side of their life that is only with adult books. How can you edit a young adult novel if you don't read Philip Roth or John Cheever or any number of newer writers? You have to have some sense of what's going on. And one of the great sorrows is talking to teachers and librarians who say, oh, I have no time to read adult books. But you have to make time and perhaps read fewer bad children's books. But if you don't have an understanding of it, you don't know what fiction is or how it is being shaped. So that goes back to my early days in publishing, when I was part of the whole procedure, not isolated. Probably the most devastating thing, if you look back in the last 30 years, is the isolation of children's book departments. They're left to their own devices, and as long as they meet their economic expectations, they're largely left alone. But one of the reasons I left publishing was when sales and marketing people, whom I admired, began to say, no, there's no market for that. And I found myself having to figure out a way to get around their no's to get a yes. And I spent more time being a politician than I did doing my actual job. And that was what was so disheartening nearly 15 years ago. And I don't think it's any better for people today. Most of the editors I know are extraordinary readers in the adult world, and many of the writers. But very few teachers and librarians that I've talked to are as adamant about finding time for adult books.
Interesting, because that's something that I've always thought about, that, you know, it does get easy when you're in children's books to not have time for it. But it is a real loss, because that's what you usually love.
Has formed itself to the exclusion of the adult books. I mean, unless you have the sheer force of personality to do it, but most juvenile editors, even heads of departments, are not involved with any editorial decisions for the rest of the house. And this is, of course, the terror of celebrity publishing, which has always been there. Those books are not being bought, for the most part, by the editors of the children's book departments. They're being acquired by heads of houses and by people who meet famous people. Oh, there's a children's book. Sometimes they will turn it over to the juvenile department, sometimes not. And you can have catastrophic effects. I mean, just the fact that any comedian or public figure can put something together. And I mention the Madonna books not because I have any aversion to Madonna, but those stories were badly written, but magnificently produced. Talk about paper and binding. The care was extraordinary. But the books were dogs, essentially, in my view. And most of these books disappear without a trace. A few have serious writers. Just the Harper author, Jamie Lee Curtis, actually has a feel for the way small children think that is genuine. And but they're among the very few exceptions, those books. And, of course, the thing is, celebrity books get out in the marketplace, and they're bought, if they're bought at all, by people who want a souvenir of the famous person. Libraries who buy them, most, obviously not all, should be ashamed of themselves, because that's a bit of commerce they don't need. Now, librarians worry about circulation, but the argument 30 years ago about paperbacks was, we won't buy them because they're not good enough, they fall apart, they're not worth our money. But when we were first at Dell, we sent out free paperbacks to schools and libraries across the country, pocketed, and asked them when the pocket was full to return the book to us. And almost all those books held up for 15 or 20 readings, even though they were bound in a glue binding. But the circulation figures shot up for titles. Judy Blume is the perfect example of someone who got decent reviews, but not thrilled reviews in her hardcovers. It was only when her books went into paperback and the children found them, and they were in mall chain stores across the country, which had foot traffic. And I've said this in the past, but who were these clerks at Walden and Dalton in those days? I didn't ask you what you were buying. They just wanted your money. And unless it was clearly inappropriate, you know, Henry Miller, you know, being sold to an 8-year-old, they weren't going to say anything about it. So the kids had a sense of selection that was more pure than today's pre-selected. The self-censorship of publishers and adults for children is always present, and I suppose will always be there. Though certainly things are more liberal in some ways. But then you look at the Newbery winner of a couple of years ago, where the single word scrotum caused such a stir. And you can't battle that kind of reactionary thinking, in my view. It's what it is, you accept it. Even though not one person at Simon & Schuster who published that book, including Dick Jackson, the editor, who's a very alert and responsive editor, ever thought for a moment that scrotum would be a word that would be difficult for any. So, what do you say?
One thing I wanted to ask you, given where we're at, is Golden Books was started during the Depression and obviously has endured those books. How do you think publishers today are going to weather difficult times in the economy? I mean, the other thing that they're obviously up against is different multimedia and all kinds of other competing technologies and things competing for kids' attention.
Well, I think they're going to find ways. One of the things, of course, is there'll probably for a time be fewer beautiful books that might cost $20, $25. Most picture books today are somewhere between $17 and $20. And picture books in paperback have never quite taken off. So there may be new technologies, maybe just paper overboard. Some publishers already do that. Certainly they're thinking about different ways to publish. There's recently been a series of pieces in that Wisconsin blog about board books and which are the most books that are designed to be in board books, or books like Goodnight Moon, which have found their way into board book form. And some people think that's a good idea, some people don't. But I think the major change that has occurred is more books for younger kids, and I think that's where we're going to catch them. Paperbacks, well, in the UK, for instance, almost all original fiction is done in paperback. They don't do it in hardcover at all. And that may happen here, because $15, $20 novels for young people are tough for most people to absorb. The uses in librarianship may be that it's better to buy 10 paperbacks than it is one glorious hardcover. But certainly people are going to be rethinking the way they're doing things, because retail price is going to be very important for a while. But the hardest part of all this is the way most of the large conglomerate houses are set up. It's the fighting for independence from the whole that is so tough for juvenile departments. And some of the decisions that they may be inclined to make are not necessarily allowed in the corporate structure. So I think the heads of those conglomerate houses, each, say Penguin, Simon & Schuster, Random House, each has a head who's going to spend probably less time on individual product acquisition than new ways of doing things. They're going to be managers in a far larger sense, perhaps less editorially involved, because if those important people were more involved in managerial thinking, true managerial thinking, they might find some solutions for some of this. I've been fascinated by trying to remember the name of the Scholastic 39 Clues as a kind of modem for future. Certainly, there's at least one other major company, Harper, which is doing it with something called the Amanda Project, which will be multiple books and involved with the internet, game playing, role playing, all that sort of thing. But how many of those can happen? If everybody were to come out in the same year with something of that sort, will they knock each other out? Probably. So I don't see it as something that can be for everyone. But each large house is going to try it. In the 39 Clues, I've read the first three, and the third is, I think, the best. That's a personal observation. because it's the wittiest, and because the writer of the third had the occasion to read the and correct some of the things. But most series aren't allowed three books before they get into their full-scale momentum. If you're doing a traditional series, if you don't hit it the first time out, no matter how many have been signed up, the series may be canceled before you get book three and four. So trying to think the whole scheme through is more and more tough. There's money up front, but it doesn't necessarily all get paid.
Well, that was similar, I guess, to what we saw in the 80s with all the different publishers simultaneously coming out with, you know, gambling on different series, different genres, things like that.
It's marvelous to see a statistic of how many of those series were published and how many failed, because I would bet 75% of them failed in all age groups and in all. There's so much copycat publishing. And it's hard for me to, I understand the attraction of saying, let's do another shape-shifting novel or some such. But if you aren't trying to make it distinctly different, how can you acquire it with any reasonability? It's just a bum investment. So it's a rugged thing.
So it doesn't really sound like it's getting much easier as a business. Maybe we didn't. We're just not going to think that. So, one last question. So, as let's say, as a an educator, as a parent, looking for books that'll capture kids, which is always partly the question. It's hard to, you know, in this competing thing. What are some of the kinds of things if someone wants to start with a young child, what would the first approach from your perspective be in how they should think about the child and what might grab them with a book?
I think you have to be totally confident about your own taste, and what amuses you is going to amuse your child. And I think that parents, if I had a young child today, I don't have any of my own, but I have lots of friends who have very young children, and I must say I go for the things that have worked. Goodnight Moon, if you've never encountered it, for all its old-fashionedness, is virtually foolproof. The books that I was passionate about as a child, those are the books that sell in bookstores. Talk to any bookseller. Make friends of booksellers. Don't be afraid to ask things. And of librarians, because there's nobody more generous with information than a librarian. And even if they, and most of them will say, gosh, I don't like this much, but the kids seem to love it. And of course, listen to your children, because you're going to hear what their friends liked. And they're so peer conscious that they're going to say, I want to read The Hardy Boys. Great. I want to read whatever it is. Just listen to what your children are doing. My father, I don't want to sound sentimental, but he was the one who always took us to the library. And we fell in love with all those Stratemeyer Syndicate books. And the library that I had growing up in New Jersey had all the original Tom Swifts. And what was so brilliant about those novels to be read later was that Tom Swift and his flying machine, Tom didn't know it was called an airplane, but I did. So the sense of, oh, that's an airplane, and discovering that Tom didn't know what he had made them more exciting than any updated version of Tom Swift. We went to the original Hardy Boys, the original Nancy Drews. Also, don't worry about what your children do in terms of boys' books and girls' books, because we have readers who will read anything set in front of them, and they devour them. I had a wonderful librarian in Kansas City with whom I was recently in touch, because I was such an avid reader as a 10, 11-year-old. And I read girls' books unabashedly, because I was fascinated by horses. And in those days, they were mostly, it was Zane Grey or horse books for girls. And this librarian, I said, I can't check those out because you signed your name on the card and everybody would know. It would be too humiliating. And she said, let's pick another name. And so we got through it. Today, that isn't a problem. But in those days, so we picked another name. And I read without any fear of discovery. So you have to figure out what are your children up against and help them to get through those things. And there are things today that must But all this slotting, boys' books, girls' books, and particularly things like it's too old for you. How many parents have you heard in a bookstore as a child brings up a book they're interested in? And I've heard parents say, it's too old for you. You can't handle that. The putting down of children in public places. Once, years ago in San Francisco, I interrupted one of these scenes, and I said, oh, ma'am, to the mother, if he's interested, you should let him read it. Well, she did not take kindly to my interference. And probably it didn't work, but I just couldn't help myself. But I see it all the time. It's not a matter of saving money. It's imposing your taste. I said it to my own son on pop-up books. I said, oh, you don't want that nasty little pop-up book from Hong Kong. And he said, yes, I do. And then I heard myself and thought, okay. So don't be afraid to be wrong in front of your child in book judgments.
And that's something where, you know, we think it's okay to do airplane reading or any kind of reading that as an adult we're just in the mood to do something, but we're not necessarily giving the same latitude to our children. But thank you, George. It was great. And, you know, hopefully people find it helpful as they're looking at stuff with the kids,
I hope so. Thanks. It was fun to talk about.